aren't even looking.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this April 6th, 2011 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each and every week, Barbara and I are here with authors, poets, literary agents, giving you the latest and most up-to-date information on the publishing world. If you are in our area and haven't heard, this Saturday, April 9th, is the 5th annual Literary Orange event here at UCI. It's a great day. It's a full day of panelists and keynote speakers. They serve you breakfast. There's a good lunch. Jeff Parker, who has been on the show and in our Pen on Fire salons many, many times, will be one of the keynote speakers. The great Ron Hansen is the other. Barbara is moderating a fiction panel. I'm moderating a humorous memoir panel. And to that end, I'm lucky enough this morning to be joined by one of my panelists, Amy Alcon. And coming up in the second half hour, we're going to stick with memoir, but we're going to switch gears to a little more serious topic. Tracy Ross will be here with her memoir, The Source of All Things. Amy Alcon writes the award-winning nationally syndicated advice column, The Advice Goddess, and has appeared on Good Morning America, The Today Show, NPR, CNN, MTV, Politically Incorrect, and Nightline. Amy blogs daily at advicegoddess.com, can be found on Twitter at Amy Alcon. And her book, I See Rude People, One Woman's Battle to Beat Some Manners into Impolite Society, is published by McGraw-Hill, and will drive a little bit of our discussion this morning. Amy, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Before we dive into the book, why don't we start with your beginnings as writer, blogger, columnist, how you got into all of this. Can you talk a little bit about your path into this?
Sure. The truth is, actually, I only do six things well, and one of them is napping. And so luckily, I found out that I was a writer very early on just by writing. I mean, that's how you become a writer, is you write. And so I wrote stories. I wrote fictional stories, which I'm not very good at, but then I wrote for my high school newspaper. I wrote a funny column about what was happening in school and won some awards. And then I went off to college and didn't really know if I'd become a writer, but I started giving free advice in the street corner with two other women as a joke. And I write humor, and so all the stuff that I do is sort of funny in my life. And we actually got a book deal and a column. I got us these things, a column in the New York Daily News. But I had this writing experience where I tried to write journalism. Sorry, I left that out. I thought I would become a journalist. And what's so important is to try to do internships in what you like and experience what you like. So I went to Washington and got a job at UPI, an internship, and I discovered that I hated writing about what other people do. Because it sounded like I had no experience for the column and this other stuff, but I actually had a lot of experience as a writer, but decided this makes me miserable, and so I had to rethink my idea of myself. But that training in journalism had given me really, really good training for how to write truthful, real-life stuff, but that's funny.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about writing humor,
sure.
Because you're fabulous at it, and that tapping into the human experience. I assume now, is that your voice sort of kind of in an everyday sort of conversation with friends' voice, or is that something that you had to work on and cultivate in writing?
Well, the voice in my column is me on steroids, I think. You know, I mean, it's the way I think if I'm standing in the grocery line trying to entertain myself. But also, what people don't understand about writing is that writing is rewriting. Mm. And sometimes you come up with a funny line, and I usually have sort of a weird and funny take on life, a sort of absurdist take, but that I'll think about a situation and think, what's that like? And start writing a whole bunch of ideas down. I sometimes write 40 pages of, well, crap for my column to get to one 800-word piece, because I have to write out the stuff to be funny and then string it together. Mm-hmm. It's not just I sit down and I write, oh, funny, 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 coming right out of the keyboard.
Right, right. Yeah, and the other thing is writing funny to tap into something that everybody can relate to, and, you know, not alienating some of your readers. You know, I know telemarketers and neglectful parents and right. Fred Lopez are probably
right.
Take issue. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, you know, I call it what I do, like, give it up writing. And I realized this when I wrote the book proposal with my partners. I wrote the first chapter for our Advice Ladies book when we were giving free advice in the street corner. And it was this whole book of, there we were on the street corner and De Niro discovered us. And my partners read it and said, I hate us. And the truth was, I had no money. I couldn't afford a bed. I was sleeping on a door, you know, on two milk crates. And people want to know your humiliation. They don't want to know how wonderful you are.
Yeah.
And that's the stuff people connect with. And so now I'll tell people anything about myself. And that's what you have to do to be a writer. You can't be precious. And sometimes it's going to upset your family. Try to change the names.
I love it. All right, let's talk about the book so people at least know what we're talking about when we refer to it. Tell me a little bit about I See Rude People and your inspiration for writing it.
Okay, this comes out of my life. And people's lives, they have stories in them that connect together. And this is what happened to me. I'm basically a meddling scold. I'm from Michigan, and I was raised to be decent and considerate to other people. And about 10 years ago, I started to see that we were all living in Meanland, and people were becoming rude to each other. And I started to speak up to people. And that was just sort of a little thing I was doing. You know, if people were doing nasty things to other people, I would say something. But then my car got stolen. I had a 1960 powder pink Rambler. And I really thought, you know, people in my neighborhood have the club on their cars, but I thought I was protected from theft by the color pink. I was not. I chased my car thief for 2.5 months, didn't know him, but tracked him down, had my mother and Marlon Brando call him and yell at him. Marlon was a friend. And this sort of crystallized for me that you aren't a victim if you act like you're not a victim, even if you don't solve your problem. And then I started seeing all these other things where I would go after people who behave badly. I started to see a through line. I started to see, wow, these are cohesive. And I put them together in a book and used my studies in anthropology. I just got back from an evolutionary psychology conference in Binghamton. I used that to figure out why people are rude and how to change things based in science and put that all together as one cohesive book.
Tell me a little bit about evolutionary psychology. This was the first time I ran into that phrase, and I'm intrigued by it. Tell me a little bit about the study of it and how you got into it.
Sure. Well, giving free advice in the street corner, well, I guess I should tell you what ev-psych is first. It's basically the study of why we are the way we are based on our evolved brains. We're basically living in modern times with Stone Age brains, and sometimes that doesn't work so well for us. Where back in the Pleistocene, you needed to grab any sweet you could off a bush so you wouldn't starve to death, and now you can drive to Costco and have some nice young man load a pallet of Twinkies into your car. You know, and so we still have the genes that say, sugar, eat that, go get that now. So it's a problem for us. But I look at basically the Stone Age brains we have and try to figure out how do we make those work in the society we have? How do we recognize our our evolved psychology to manage our lives better.
Yeah.
And basically, when I was giving free advice in the street corner and people were asking us actual questions, we had a sign that said free advice. We thought everyone would pass us on the street corner in New York, and they lined up around the block. We just did this for a joke, but I thought, wow, I better know something. And so I read all of psychology, and then I started reading these, you know, these studies and reading these books on F-Psych and saw that there was a lot that they had to tell us about how to live based on how we behave and how we think.
Yeah, yeah. My guest this morning is Amy Alcon. The book is I See Rude People. How long were you out on the street corner? How long did you do that?
From about 1998 to about the mid, 1988 or 89 to the mid-90s.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh.
What was really fun, we just intended to go out one day as a joke and just sit there. I made us assign free advice from a panel of experts. It was like love and dating, nail biting, you know. And people just thought it was hilarious and sat down because the sign said free. Another reason the sign said free, low self-esteem. We thought, you know, Lucy, advice, 5 cents. I thought, no one's going to give us a nickel. So that's why it said free. And it was really, really fun. And so this is an example where all the stuff that made me a loser my entire life is now making me money, that I'm weird, I do weird things. You know, I would like to put a loudspeaker on my car and yell at people who are rude in traffic. I don't do that because I think it's illegal and probably rude. But those things, if people look at their lives and the stuff that they're ashamed to tell other people, that's the stuff you should write about.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I can't imagine that that hasn't been turned into a book. Have you thought about doing your time on the street as a sort of a memoir?
Oh, we have. We did a book, my former partners and I, one of whom has died, unfortunately. It's called Free Advice, you know, after Steal This Book, The Advice Ladies on Love, Dating, Sex, and Relationships.
That's right. I did read that. Yeah.
And it's actually sort of pre-research Amy, but there's still a lot of fun stuff in it. We have pictures of things like, there's a picture of us in wigs and beards, you know, out at a restaurant, and there's some funny stuff in there because we're all you know into writing funny stuff. So I sort of can't help but write funny things.
Yeah. Now tell me about finding the topics and defining the scope for this book.
For my Rude People book.
Right.
I took the theme line rudeness and rude people, and I just looked through my life at all the ways I'm annoying, basically. For example, I'm a libertarian and a fiscal conservative, and I don't like when people take things from me. So I'm not anti-business, but I pay for my phone line, and so I can make people's marketing costs cheaper, and I value my time. So when telemarketers call me, I am not mean to the person on the phone who has a bad job and makes very little money. I find out the company they're selling for, find a honcho at the company, look their name up on a place called Zabasearch.com, Zabasearch.com. Then I call them at home, chew them out for calling me at home, and I invoice them for use of my time and my phone line, and I get them to pay me. I've gotten hundreds of dollars. So that's an example of just, here's my life. Oh, that fits under the rubric of rude people. It's business rudeness. That'll go in the book. And all the different areas. Rude, you know, parents who underparent their children. It's not the children's fault, so I call it the underparented child. Internet rudeness. All these things, I just looked at my life and found examples that rounded out a book.
I love it. You know, these could go on and on. I imagine that you've had a fair number of people suggest more topics to you because, you know, it's probably endless. Have you considered a second book out of this?
I'm working on one now. It's more of a comprehensive manners book because this one had these stories in it about things that I do, but this is advice for all the areas. You know, basically, it is the anti-etiquette book. I don't really have a dining table that I can eat on. You know, I don't know how to cook. I heat. You know, but this is a book about how to treat other people. And how to treat other people in a world where all of a sudden we have all these new parameters like Facebook, you know, and people are on cell phones all the time. You know, it's not like your Aunt Gert could tell you good cell phone behavior.
Right.
You know, we get the technology and the manners follow.
Exactly.
Or
right.
Don't.
Right, or don't. Right, right. Or spin out of control. Yeah.
Right, right.
My guest this morning is Amy Alcon. Amy and I are going to be together this Saturday at UCI at the Literary Orange event on a panel. Great event. I don't know if registration is still open, but you can check them out at literaryorange.com to see Amy. I was chatting with somebody else about this new genre coming out of shticklet and, you know, kind of taking something out of your life and some shtick from your life and turning it into literature. And
right.
It sort of struck me that this falls into that genre. And I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about your pitching process when you took the book out and sold the book and kind of the book proposal and how much it differs from the end product.
Oh, I'd love to do that. One thing I just want to say so I don't forget is that one of the most important parts of my process is having my stuff edited before it goes out. I actually hire somebody to edit me. Her job is to tell me I'm not funny, you know, it's not making sense, it's not clear the science is wrong, because then I put it out and it's right. So everything from my proposal to every word I write that gets published goes through this editor. And people can have their friends do this, but don't have your mother do it. Don't have somebody who's going to be critical. Have somebody whose mind and literary judgment you respect.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to pay them, but it's a really good idea.
Yeah, a great idea. Yeah, your comment about this being mostly editing and revising is so right.
It sure is. And then my other thing that is part of my process, whether it's a proposal or anything else, three words, butt in chair. You know, you just have to sit down when it's horrible, it's not coming, you hate the blank page. Too bad. Make yourself write for an hour before you check your email. I don't care if you write, I'm stupid. Finally, you'll get bored with that. You'll write something worthwhile.
Fabulous.
So, but back to your question, the proposal process, I really hate, but it really, writing a proposal helps you realize what your book is and what's stupid and wrong that you're thinking. Mm. And there's a lot of stuff in there about, you know, who's my audience, who am I selling to? I hate writing all that stuff, but that's important too. Really helps you solidify it. And my old agent, John Boswell, wrote a book called The Awful Truth About Publishing that's since been retitled. Sorry, I don't remember the new title, but if you look up John Boswell, and it's not Boswell and Johnson, you know, on the internet, you can probably find it. It's very good. He's a chapter 13, Sell the Sizzle, Not the Steak. That's very important when you're writing a proposal. You want to show people why you have a platform, why you have an audience, why this book's exciting, and not sort of reinvent the wheel on the page. And you write sample chapters for this. That's very important. And I do find that my stuff changes. I find that this is something that editors didn't really understand. You know, it used to be so much easier to sell a book. So you could just say, hi, I put words on a page, and they, you know, people publish them, and they'd give you $50,000. And now you really have to convince them. I had two publishing companies drop out of the bidding process. One thought they'd be sued. Now, I'm a newspaper columnist, and I have libel slander insurance. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know how to write without libeling people, even when I'm writing a book about how people are rude. They could have had a conversation with me, but they didn't. So in my new proposal for this book, I put in, you know, please ask me if you have any questions or concerns. I literally put that in, like they couldn't figure that out. And then the other company dropped out because I think that they felt one of the chapters was too strident. Well, I had written it for a men's magazine, and, you know, I hadn't quite really gone over it the way I do for a fully, you know, for a book that I'm publishing. You know, I just thought, here, it's pretty good. I'll put this in. And that was kind of a mistake. I needed to go over it a little more than I did. There was just a word in there, I think, that grated on them. So those are some of the examples where I've learned things from my mistakes, and now I'm much more totally careful and panic-stricken, paranoid when I put out a proposal.
Tell me about platform and how much that plays a role in both the selling of this book, but how much importance you place on platform, keeping the blogs going, keeping the advice column going, and having your name out there, and how much that contributed to the success of this.
It really, really matters having a platform. You need to, people think that they're just going to come out, they're going to write their book, and then they're going to start a blog the next day. You have to have a loyal audience, and that's part of what sells books. People sell books off blogs, you know, all the time, you know, not all of them are good, but sometimes they just care that you have an audience. Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, I want to write good books. I don't really care if I just sell things as much as I like to eat and go to France. But so I have this column that's in papers across the country. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I will friend anybody but, like, Adolf Hitler, who friends me on Facebook, you know, because I am not looking at Facebook as some way to tell, like, oh, I had tea this morning. This is the way I post links for my blog, and I use that to increase my traffic. Same thing with Twitter. I do not ever post anything dull about my life, you know, unless it's making – I make fun of myself on Twitter or something sometimes, but it always has to be funny. You have to have that high standard. People are too loose and easy about the stuff they publish, and you lose audience that way. You know, I live with the fear that I'm going to bore people, and that's one of the best things keeping you from being a hack.
Right.
One of the things that I find that people who don't have a platform where their newspaper columnists do that's helpful is to go on Goodreads and these other sites. There are self-published writers who have built a huge following, you know, just by being on these sites and being a regular commenter and saying smart things. That's the thing. You can't just be out there. You have to give people something for their attention. And if you're smart and you're posting stuff, if you're a real thinker, if you don't just put out your first thought, this is what I don't do. I try to always, with everything I write, to give people something they're not going to get elsewhere. Because I'm weird, because I thought about it more, because I researched it more, because otherwise it's a huge, just crowded world of people publishing stuff. Now, $1,200, you got a book out, you know, and you have to compete with those people by giving them something that's not in all those other books.
Right. My guest this morning is Amy Alcon. The book is I See Rude People. Can you tell over the past, let's say, year where most of your traffic is coming from? If you have more people following you on your blogs, I mean, your syndicated columns are hard to follow circulation, but you know, through Facebook or through some of the other social mediums on the internet where you can track people, can you kind of sense shifts in trends of where people follow people more?
Well, here's what happens with me. There isn't one area things come from, except when I blog something that's extraordinary, I'm going to blog a TSA experience I had soon and tell people basically, don't go quietly. I sobbed my guts out at the TSA thing. I felt tears coming on, and I thought, you know what? I'm so opposed to what they do. I call it security theater, looking for tweezers, not terrorists. But I thought, you don't get to violate my Fourth Amendment rights and have it be pleasant. So I just sobbed the whole time. And then I told them. I mean, so this is something I'm going to write about, and probably Glenn Reynolds, who's one of the biggest bloggers, I'm hoping will be interested in this and link to this. When Glenn links to you, it's called an Insta-launch from Instapundit, you get thousands, you get like 10,000 more people than you would have had on your blog, and some of those people will be what I call sticky. They will find you and like you and come back. They'll buy my book, you know. So that's the thing you have to do, is write stuff that's extraordinary. But you can't just make stuff up. There are people that do that, you know, that sort of try to be out there for out there's sake. It has to be coming from a position of truth, and that's really a thing that's important with humor writing, that it has to be stuff that people relate to, and it just really has to be true. If you're lying, it just won't be as funny.
Right, right. Let's talk about ghostwriting a little bit. You had talked about the need for ghostwriters in pop science and in psychology.
Oh, you mean ghost editors?
Ghost editors. I'm sorry. Yes, ghost editors.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I just talked to people at the anthropology conference about this, or the off-site conference, because they... Oh, sorry. There's a fire engine. I'll go in the back of my
house. No worries.
You know, they're talking about part of this conference was applied evolutionary psychology, which is what I do. I take people's research. Unlike Gladwell, Malcolm Gladwell, who reports on people's research, I'm so intimate with the research, I can create new things out of it. So I create advice out of the ivory tower stuff. I translate it and everything for people's lives. And I was telling the people there, look, if you want to make your stuff practical, you can't just put out a book, here's my pop science book. It has to be completely readable. And writing readable science writing is so hard. And that's one reason why it's really important to have somebody read your stuff. You know, a lot of my friends, Sundar Singh Lowe, Janet Fitch, these people, they're all started out in writers groups on, you know, over in Silver Lake, which is on the other side of the world from me, and before I got here. But they all criticized each other's writing. My friend Sue Shapiro does that in New York. She had a writer's workshop in her house for years. Jerry Jonas from The New Yorker would come criticize your work. Now, not everybody can be in an environment like that, but you need to get around people who are writing seriously. Not those people who want to write, who say, I'm going to write, but people who sit there every day in a closet and pound out their novel and actually have some judgment. Because if they don't have judgment, you're making a mistake by letting them opine on your work and taking it sort of seriously.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's always hard to know which advice. We talk a lot about writing groups on this show, and it's always hard to know which advice you should listen to. I guess once you've been at it long enough and you sort of get the rhythm and flow of your own work and what you're looking for, it gets a little bit easier to tell, you know, which advice you should take and who's credible to listen to.
Well, here's one thing I would suggest, and I hope it's okay to say this because I don't make any money from this and neither does she. Susan Shapiro, I think she's Susan Shapiro, yes, SusanShapiro.net, my friend Sue, one of the most generous people in terms of writing and writing advice. She has a list of ghost editors, people that you pay. And I would suggest having stuff professionally edited at least once, because that will teach you so much. That's a person who's going to know stuff, you know, look at it on a professional level, and you'll be able to see, you know, it's just going to give you a better sense of what to do and not to do. You know, I mentor my own assistant. She got a column in McSweeney's. I would sit there and just, like, grind down about, no, this isn't making sense. You can't write that. And then you're coming from a place of experience when you sit there with somebody in a writer's group, and you can know whether to discount or whether to take their advice a little better.
Yeah, right, right. Was there any challenge in this book in going from columns which are short and quippy to the long, and kind of making that transition from, you know, you have to cut words to you have to write more?
Oh, my God. Writing my columns, the hardest thing I do. Writing short and making it funny and little gem-like, you know, pieces in it, that's really hard. Writing long-form prose is a total joy, except for the science parts. which are really hard. Mm-hmm. And I'm still as tough with it. And I have to tell you, every week with my column, where I'll have, it's supposed to be 800 words, and I find, you know, I have like 900 words and I have to cut, it makes it so much better. I sometimes impose on myself an artificial constraint of I have to cut 300 words from this, you know, section or chapter, because it'll make me make the writing better if you have to do that.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Absolutely. Cutting to the bone can only enhance things.
Right.
Yeah, what was the hardest part of this? Was it the writing of the science?
And I See Rude People?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, yeah. I actually didn't have the total answers for the book. That was what they should have worried about in the proposal. And I didn't realize it. The answer for why people are rude, and it turns out it's because we live in societies too big for our brains. We didn't evolve to be around strangers. And rude strangers can do anything to you if they're rude. You know, if you're a nice person, you're not going to be rude to strangers. But I didn't quite have that all together. But the thing is that I will get it all together and work, you know, crawl under furniture looking for words if I have to, you know, to make it right. And that's the thing where it's hard when with publishers when they don't know you're some stranger, you know, that they don't actually pick up the phone and call you. And so you have to write your proposal, you know, thinking of that. You know, and not assuming that they're going to just take your word for it or look at a piece of writing and think, okay, you can do the book, which is what they used to do in the golden age.
Right.
Writing.
Right, right. Oh, sadly, we're drawing down on our time, but this is one of those few times that I say, hey, we get another hour to chat again pretty soon. So that's all good.
Great.
Give me a little bit. You've given a lot of great advice already so far. And often the advice that we hear again and again on the show, you've already given out. Is there more words of wisdom for writers?
Yeah, I read this great book. Actually, I only read part of it. It's called The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield. And the great little gem in this is to be act like a professional as an amateur. You know, that you would sit down every day like Elmore Leonard used to. My boyfriend's his researcher. Elmore, before he was employed as a writer, he would sit down from 5 to 8 in the morning and write and not allow himself coffee, you know, until he had a page on a legal pad filled out, you know, with words. And so you have to have that kind of dedication. Writing's incredibly hard. Those of us who do it just can't do anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you don't have that kind of dedication, then you know what, start a blog or whatever, but don't really worry about publishing books, or you can self-publish one, but don't think of it as a profession unless you're willing to basically bleed for what you want to do.
Right, right. Great, great advice. Great advice from the advice goddess. I love it.
Thank you.
So I will see you on Saturday.
Everybody, please come.
Yes.
It's 1 to 2, right?
1 to 2
at
on Saturday.
Irvine Student Center.
Exactly right. Exactly
Thank
right.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Amy. That was Amy Alcon. The book is I See Rude People, One Woman's Battle to Beat Manners into Impolite Society. Like we said, we're going to be together at Literary Orange at UCI this coming Saturday. It's an all-day event. Check it out at literaryorange.org. You can check out Amy at advice.goddess.com, or you can follow her on Twitter at Amy Alcon. You can check her out on Facebook. She is all over the net, and her blogs and articles and book are all fabulously funny. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. We're going into the realm, going to stay in the realm of memoir, but we're going to switch gears a little bit. Tracy Ross will be with me for the second half hour with her memoir of childhood sexual abuse, The Source of All Things. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and we will be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. You know, little darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit iTunes, Talk News, or you can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, the Literary Orange event coming up this Saturday, and more. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and I'm joined now by Tracy Ross. Tracy is an award-winning journalist and contributing editor of Backpacker Magazine, an ASME award-winning outdoor publication with 1.2 million readers. She's been published in the U.S., England, South Africa, and Australia. Her essay, The Source of All Things, won the National Magazine Award in 2009 and was selected for inclusion in the Best American Sports Writing and Best American Magazine Writing. Her skiing magazine story, Our Country Comes Skiing in Peace, received a notable mention in the Best American Travel Writing, and her work has also appeared in Outside and Women's Sports Illustrated. Tracy's assignments have taken her to the wilds of Alaska, the ski slopes of Iran, and most remote regions of Ecuador. She writes about exotic places and intriguing people, but mainly about the wilderness and how it intersects with the most important issues in our lives. The Source of All Things is now a full-length memoir and will drive much of our discussion this morning. Tracy, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming on. Let's start out by allowing you to introduce The Source of All Things, kind of the subject matter and topic, as well as how it evolved into a book.
Okay. The Source of All Things is a story about my stepfather and me and a journey that we took in 2007 into the Sawtooth Mountains in southern Idaho to address issues of child abuse that began on a camping trip there in 1979. And the story started out as a magazine article, as you say, in Backpacker. I was 36 years old in 2007 and had this amazing life that, in my terms, was my dream life. I was traveling all over the place, skiing and hiking and writing about it. I had two wonderful kids, a great husband, lived in the woods above Boulder, Colorado, and I just had this underlying depression that wouldn't leave me despite all these great things. And I knew, of course, that the source of the depression was my abuse that I had suffered for several years as a kid. It was sexual abuse by my stepfather. And so the reason that I wrote that story, basically, was I knew that I had to get some answers out of my dad about what had happened to me, you know, straight from the person who had done them. And I knew, on some level, that I wanted to write about it. More so, I wanted to go back to the source of where it began, the source of all the most beautiful things, the most horrific things in my life, and confront my dad. And I also knew that there was value in writing about it. So that's how the Backpacker's story came to be. It won the National Magazine Award, which blew my mind. And then Simon & Schuster bought it, Free Press, which is a division of Simon & Schuster. And I worked on it for a year, and it came out in March.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. You know, that decision to write it for yourself versus write it for others, I think is such an interesting process and or kind of such an interesting decision to make. And it obviously tapped into something so kind of fundamental and close to the bone. I understand there was a bidding war over the book, and obviously people were kind of either identifying with or hungry for a story like this. Tell me about the decision to make something so private, so public, and the need to get the story out there.
Well, that's a great question. When I first went on the hike with my dad, my editor at Backpacker, John Dorn, he inspired me, and he sort of opened this door that I had been waiting to have open and pushed me through it in terms of the writing. But when I came back from that trip, I was so disturbed by what I had found out that I didn't think that I could write about it. I thought that it would be too painful. I didn't want people to know. I didn't know what it would mean. And he, in all of his wisdom, said, just write it. We don't have to publish it. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I'm sure all along he was thinking, of course, we're going to publish this. But it gave me the freedom to write from the heart. And once I began telling the story, the thing that captured me and kept me moving through it in terms of writing it was that I realized that it had this layer of beauty to it. I was able to tell it in an artistic way that felt beautiful to me, and I felt compassion for myself as a character and also compassion for my stepdad. And so that's how I was able to share such a personal story, because I could see the art in it and I could see the beauty in it. And writing the book was a bit of a different story. It was much more difficult for me really to access so many of the memories and to tell the whole story, which I found much more difficult to tell. You know, it was almost impossible for me to maintain the voice that I had captured in the backpacker story once I came to the book.
Yeah, it's interesting, I think, when things happen to you in sort of a distant time, that you can almost separate yourself from the person that it happened to the person you are today, and sort of, you know, have some, I don't know if you can have some sort of objectivity about making this notion of making yourself into a character as opposed to writing about yourself, I think is really interesting. And it's a great door in for people writing either tragedy or writing, you know, dark, to kind of take themselves as they who they are today kind of out of the equation and write about themselves as a character. That's really fascinating.
And so freeing and so fun in a way. You know, despite what, for me, even though this was dark subject matter, I loved being able to look at myself as a little kid and sort of celebrate all the things that I've always known were great about me at that age, just this kind of wild, dirt-eating kid who always wanted to be swimming in creeks and rivers. And, you know, I was able to sort of see what was special about me at that age, at these various ages growing up, and capture them as you would a fictional character, even though everything in the story is true.
Right. Now, this notion of accessing your memories, I'd read an interview where you talked about a conversation or maybe a thing that you read with Wells Tower about this auto-hypnosis and kind of being able to sort of hypnotize yourself, I guess. Talk a little bit about that and how you got yourself back into those mindsets.
Well, I found, and I hope auto-hypnosis is the right word. I remember reading that, and so I latched onto it. But, yeah, he talked about this idea, and it was something that I kind of learned to do and had known how to do from writing long narrative feature stories for magazines. But to get to a place, some writers write with a lot of chaos going on around them or music. Some writers write with dead silence. And for me, it's always has to be uninterrupted dead silence. And I feel like if I can stick with a scene long enough, or I have an idea of an anecdote that I want to write or a scene that I want to write, and in terms of going back to my childhood, it just took a very, very concentrated effort to hear the voices, to see the people, see what they were wearing, and also trust what I was seeing and hearing, and let the conversations where there's dialogue emerge, and not be afraid of censoring myself in those moments. So, you know, I remembered a T-shirt that my brother was reading that said Lifeguard Waikiki Beach. Well, I know that that T-shirt is what he was wearing, and that T-shirt is important in that scene. And there, you know, there will be people who say, how could you possibly remember that T-shirt? But I feel like I could go back there and see these places and then sort of fact check what I was seeing with family photographs and stuff like that.
Well, I have to say the experiences that you have as a child, regardless of what happened to you as a child, are so much more visceral, I think, than experiences that you have as an adult. I don't know if it's because you're, you know, your mind is in some sort of, you know, kind of pre-development, but you take in, I think, sensory details as a kid in a way that you just can't as an adult. And, you know, all of those little details, I'm positive, endure in ways that, you know, your parents looking back on it probably wouldn't endure. But that's really interesting. The other interesting thing about this is the connection between nature and healing, and finding the places where you and your dad connected in the same places where the pain was caused, I think is such a fascinating part. Can you talk a little bit about your connection with nature and how that has sort of been a kind of a healing process for you?
Sure. From the time, I think even before I was born, I feel like I have this genetic endowment of love of wilderness and love of nature, because my mom is from Newfoundland, Canada, which is this, you know, really wild place, and always giant storms in the ocean, and she remembers paddling her own dory out into the water over, you know, with these big whales around, and my biological father and my grandparents just deeply, deeply rooted in nature. And my grandparents both flew their own planes, and they were big fly fishermen, and they pheasant hunted. And so from the time I was very young, this was my world. And it was also the place where I felt clean and sort of beautiful and holy, I guess, just being in rivers and being outside and feeling the elements. And so, you know, when my stepfather, after my dad died on a backpacking trip of all things, when my stepfather came and sort of rescued our family from this depression that was hanging over us, he brought with him a continuation of this outdoor adventure. And suddenly he had this great Jeep and he had this cool dog, and suddenly we were skiing and hiking and just taking it steps further than I had, you know, previously. And so that was what was so damaging and horrifying about the abuse, is that it began on a camping trip in a place where I associated only fun, only joy, only beauty. Mm. But the kind of crazy thing about it is that by the time the abuse began, my stepdad and I had already forged this bond over wilderness and over being outdoors. And it is just something that has endured throughout all the pain and turmoil that we've gone through. Is as I matured into an adult and reconnected with nature and wilderness in my 20s after a period of kind of it being withheld from me, I just instinctively always saw my stepfather in that picture. And when I would reconnect with him in places like Jackson Hole, Wyoming or Alaska, I always imagined that he had been having this great wilderness experience away from me also.
Mm.
And so it was very complicated because we'd go to these beautiful places or we'd be thrown together in these beautiful places. But there was this dark thing hanging over us, which was the unresolved conversation about the abuse and why it had happened.
Mm. So, yeah, the other thing about finding the angels within the demons, I think, is and seeing him with a certain amount of compassion and writing about him not in a black and white way. I mean, none of this is a black and white issue. I think that also has kind of tapped into readers' psyche as kind of authentically emotionally true.
Mm-hmm.
Was this a would you say ultimately it was a, some memoirists have talked about it, it can't be a cathartic experience because you can't necessarily ever get over certain things that happened to you, but it can put it in a new light or put it in its place. How would you describe the experience of having written about it and coming out on the other side of the book?
It's so funny because a lot of people have said, oh, this must have been so cathartic for you. And actually, in my understanding of the definition of catharsis, it hasn't been, it's not like I came out the other side and was a whole new person and all shiny, squeaky clean, and this is an issue that is behind us.
Right.
For me, it was so painful writing this book, and so painful finding out more information as I kept going back to my dad to ask questions. At some point, I think I got a little bit of truth fatigue, and there may even be more that I haven't been able to ask, and that he hasn't been able to tell me. I can't say that for sure. But at this point, I feel like since the book has come out, the real kind of healing, and I put that in quotes, is happening now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because he finally has had to face the world with this story that he had kept hidden for so long, and that my family had let me carry as this big lie.
Right.
And so, you know, every time that an interview comes up where he's involved, or like we were in People magazine, the fact that he is sticking with it and owning up to the things that he did, to me, that is just as important and so powerful, you know, more powerful than me actually even writing the book, I think.
Right, right. My guest this morning is Tracy Ross. The book is The Source of All Things. Tell me a little bit about structuring the book and knowing which key events to put in. I assume so much had to be cut out, but kind of establishing the narrative arc. Tell me a little bit about the process of putting it together as a story and as an arc.
Well, I was lucky in the sense that I had the arc with the magazine story.
Mm.
So I knew that it would start with the hike. I knew that it would go back to the hike.
Mm-hmm.
And the magazine story was somewhere in the neighborhood of like 10 or 11,000 words, you know, which is essentially one-tenth of the book. And I just very carefully started. I talked to Dan Barry. I think I had a conversation with him. He's a New York Times columnist. We emailed or we talked, and he suggested that, you know, just sitting down and plotting it out on a timeline, and that's what I did. And I sort of plotted out the memories that stood out strongest to me over the course of my life, and then kind of grouped them into what I knew would be chapters, and followed the arc as it was sort of unfolding, I guess.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm not the best outliner. I like to kind of outline as I go, and that's something that my editor at Free Press, Dominic Anfuso, pushed me to do, was really like get a clear outline of this thing before I dove in. Because I'm a dive in and then sort of figure it out kind of writer.
Right, right.
Which doesn't always work. So, you know, I had the advantage of knowing what the story was even before I began. And then I would be surprised by things as I went through.
Yeah, I was curious about that, if there were surprises that came up for you in this process. I assume there were some things that were revealed through research and interviews that you remembered in hindsight, or that were told to you after the fact. But were there writing surprises that emerged from this for you?
Well, a couple of the biggest surprises were, one, you know, as I was working on the book proposal, which was 26,000 words, close to 100 pages, I think, my agents kept saying, the more you write now, the easier it will be once it comes to writing the book. And I just wanted to get the proposal done so that I could start really diving in with the book. And they were so right on when it came time to write, because there were chapters where I thought it would be really easy that I hadn't probably even included in the proposal, like the chapter about working with the Challenger Foundation in the Escalante Desert in southern Utah.
Mm.
That was a very visceral experience for me as a kid, you know, a 19 or 20-year-old. And so I figured I could breeze through that, writing that. And it was so difficult. That chapter was so difficult, including the Interlochen Arts Academy part that came before it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had just assumed that those would be great, easy chapters for me to write because I loved them so much in real life, like living those moments.
Yeah, right, right.
And they actually turned out to be the hardest to write about, I think because they weren't inherently dramatic.
Right, right. Yeah, it's amazing the parts that you think you're going to be able to sail through, and the things that are kind of visceral in your head, and so you assume they're going to be visceral on the page for readers, and you're right. Those often are not the easy chapters to write. And I imagine in the corollary that certain things that, I don't know if this happened to you, but certain things that you would go into thinking were going to be very difficult, I don't know if you had the experience of those just kind of flowing out of you.
Oh, I did, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think for me, I'm a Scorpio, and I kind of like the darker stories just in general. I love writing about people who have really complex problems or, you know, big things that they need to solve. And so for me, it was much, much easier in one sense, not so emotionally, but from a writing standpoint, to write like the abuse scene in the trailer.
Yeah, right.
Because it was so, I could feel it. I could feel every emotion.
Right.
And so that made it, you know, easier for me to kind of access not only the action, but the meaning.
Right, right. Yeah, this gift that you have of turning the dark into something so beautiful, I think it's very unique and just gorgeous. I don't know how hard you had to work at your voice in this, or if that is just sort of a natural voice that comes easily to you. But that like I say, gift of putting tangible, beautiful imagery and beautiful ideas to something that's hard for people to kind of emotionally, you know, keep their hand to the flame of that particular fire is really a treat.
Thank you. The natural world really helps with that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it would, and that is such a beautiful part of the country. My family hails from that exact area, so it's just gorgeous up there. Let's see. How long is your reading? Because I'd love to have you read to us, but we're running out on time here.
I was just going to read a little from the prologue. I didn't time it, but I think it's not, I mean, it might be 2 minutes.
Okay. Let's go and we'll end on that.
Okay. So this is from the prologue, Redfish Lake, Idaho, July 2007. All my dad has to do is answer the questions. That's it. Just 4 simple questions. Only they aren't that easy because questions like these never are. We are almost to the temple, 3 days deep in the craggy maw of Idaho's Sawtooth Mountains, and he has no idea the questions are coming. But I have them loaded, hot and explosive, like shells in a 30-30. It's July and hotter than hell on the sage-covered slopes where wildfires will char more than 130,000 acres by summer's end. But we're up high, climbing to 9,000 feet, and my dad, who is really my stepdad, says that this heat feels cooler than the heat in Las Vegas where he lives. 4 days ago, he and my mother met me in Twin Falls, a town 140 miles south of here where I grew up. They'd driven north, across Nevada, past other fires, including one on the Idaho border. When I saw my mom at a friend's house where she'd wait while Dad and I backpacked, she'd seemed even tinier than her 4-foot-11-inch frame. Her sweatpants, plucked from the sale bin at a Las Vegas Abercrombie & Fitch store, drooped like month-old lettuce over her bum. In the creases of her mouth, a white paste had congealed, proof that she was taking antidepressants again. Officially, she said that she's glad Dad and I are going back to the place our troubles began 28 years ago, almost to the day. But as I kissed her goodbye, leaving her standing in our friend's driveway, I wondered, which way is the wind now blowing? At sunrise this morning, Dad and I slid out of our bags, made breakfast, and caught a few fish. When we finally started hiking, we climbed out of one basin and into another, inching up switchbacks sticky with lichen and loose with scree. At the edge of one overlook, we saw smoke rising on the horizon from a fire that was crowning in the trees. And when we arrived at the lake with the dozen black frogs chirping across the water, we called it Holy Water Lake because it was Sunday, and we did feel a bit closer to God. I know my dad is hurting because I am hurting too, and not just my legs and lungs or the bottoms of my feet. We have barely spoken since we left the dock at Redfish Lake, left the boat, and the worried Texans who said, "You're going where?" I'm sure we seemed an odd pair, an old man, and what was I? Daughter? Lover? Friend? When we stepped off the boat, I'd wanted to turn back, forget this whole sordid mess. But the temple, a spot on the map I'd latched onto and couldn't let go of, was out here somewhere, and besides, I still hadn't decided if I was going to kill him outright or just walk him to death.
Tracy, that was beautiful. That was Tracy Ross. The book is The Source of All Things. Thank you so much this morning.
Thank you.
That, unfortunately, is all the time we have for today. I'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning with Stuart Onan and Olga Grushin. Stay tuned. Positive Vibrations with Sister Rue is coming up next. And until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.